You're listening to the Afterburn Podcast, episode number 10.
Goulian is in the groove. He's found the rhythm. He's found the flow of the course. And right now seems to have this under control. And he's on track to take the lead and take the lead with a good time.
This gate here has got to put the nose to the left of the gate to take up with the inertia there so you don't roll into the gate or pile on like Matt Holden.
Goulian's getting faster and faster. The light stays green. The plane is getting quicker. Goulian into the lead. And the time is rock solid. The American fans are on their feet already.
6.208 seconds, no penalties. Currently holds you in first place.
Altitude.
Tower 26 is released to you. Runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5. Clear for takeoff.
Seat tied. Altitude 0 eyes. We're clear for takeoff. Clear for the airspace.
Fly protector. Low speed. Fly protector. Fly protector. Fly protector.
Viper 01, be advised, the restricted 6002 is still active.
Sir, yeah, that's on.
Doctor, picture 610-13,000. Target is in the back.
Viper 1 targeted.
I'm excited for my guest today, Michael Goulian, a good friend of mine. The audio you heard in the opening was him winning the Red Bull Air Race at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in 2018. Quite an accomplishment. Michael's career in aviation is accomplished. One of the youngest guys to win the United States Unlimited Aerobatic Championship at age 27. He's a certified flight instructor. He's a Cirrus instructor. He is the guy you want to emulate in the aviation career field, in my opinion, just from his professionalism, his dedication, his drive, and even not just necessarily just aviation, but he's a business owner. A lot of things Mike has learned over the years and he's sharing, just the way he conducts himself is something that I think most people would find success if they were able to figure out how to capture and emulate what Mike does. So excited for Mike to be on the podcast today. Hope you enjoy. Before we get rolling, we just have a few admin notes. I'd like to thank Hangar 24 Craft Brewing out in Redlands, Orange County, and Lake Havasu. They make some amazing beer out there, but one thing they've done during these times is they pivoted and they've actually made hand sanitizer. If you're in need, they ship hand sanitizer all across the United States. You can use the code RAIN10, that's RAIN10, and get 10% off your hand sanitizer order. And if you're just looking for some great quality beer and you happen to be in the SoCal region or over in Lake Havasu, you can find them at most grocery stores, liquor stores, or you can visit their tap rooms at one of those locations. Again, that's hangar24brewing.com. Go over and check them out. I'd also like to thank Squadron Posters. Not only am I a fan of Squadron Posters, but I've been a customer of theirs for about 4 years now. A few years back, a member of my squadron worked with the Squadron Posters design team to build a custom poster for our squadron, the 77th Fighter Squadron. After seeing the end result, I not only ordered that poster, but I ordered the posters for all my previous units as well. Squadron Posters is a great way to capture your memories and showcase the places you've traveled, where you've lived, and some of the amazing things you've accomplished. Check out SquadronPosters.com and their truly unique artwork. Let Squadron Posters custom art help you showcase and share your journey today. Use the code RAIN10 for 10% off your order of $59 or more. Also, I'd like to thank Wingman Watches, which is a veteran-owned and operated company. Their impeccable attention to detail truly shows in each one of their timepieces. They've grown and they've created some truly incredible timepieces. If your organization or group might be interested in creating a custom watch, I highly recommend you check out Wingman Watches. Their design team will take care of all the hard work from taking your concept and shaping it into something you will love, providing you a one-stop shop for your team members to purchase their personal watch. Perfect for law enforcement, fire departments, medical, sports teams, military, and any organization. Let Wingman Watch build your watch for your team today. Check out wingmanwatch.com to start your order. Mention my name to receive a discount on your group order, or if you see a watch you already love on the site, you can use the code RAIN10 to receive 10% off your watch purchase. You'll just say something real quick. I'll make sure it's working.
Test 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Honestly, that's the best one I've had yet.
Wow. You say that to all the boys.
Yeah. Well, no, just you. You're special. Okay, you are a pilot. You are a pilot, right?
I was at one time.
Well,
just Mike, ask me.
I'm super excited you joining me on the podcast tonight. I know people are going to love hearing your story. Before we get rolling into it, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are, what you're doing today, and how you got there?
Well, you know, like I tell everybody, I thought I was going to be the next Bobby Orr hockey player growing up in Boston, Massachusetts. And then when you get to be about a senior in high school, you realize, well, like, well, I probably need about another 6 inches of height, maybe about 30 more pounds. And that wasn't going to happen. So my dreams were crushed. I was not going to be the next Bobby Orr or Wayne Gretzky. That it is what it is. So my dad was a flight school owner. He started a flying school in 1964. He was one of these guys that really, like, a white scarf guy, didn't do anything else with his life but fly airplanes, was flying when he was a kid. Cool story. They actually, his dad and he forged his birth certificate, which you could do back then, so he could solo a plane at 15 instead of 16. So, yeah, really cool. And so by the time I was in high school, you know, we had this flight school going. He started in 1964. And he was one of these guys that he's like, hey, I want you to see what we do. You know, what puts food on the table and hockey skates and hockey sticks in your hands and on your feet, and figure out what we do. And he wanted me to understand the value of a buck, right? So when I was probably, I don't know, my 15 years old, he brought me to the airport, and I can remember he had this white Chevrolet Impala with an orange Chevy Impala with a white roof and white interior. It was a classic 1980s thing. And this guy didn't believe in air conditioner. Why would you have an air conditioner when you can roll down the windows, right? So we go to the airport in this car. Remember, like it was yesterday. He pulls up in front of the hangar, and he's like, boys, this is Michael. Michael, this is the boys. Boys, give him a broom. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. This is the worst summer of my entire life, right? So that's how it started. And, you know, these mechanics are probably 28 years old, 30-something years old, and they just abused me for a whole summer, and I loved every minute of it, right? And because by the end of the summer, I was taxiing airplanes, washing airplanes, giving them as much grief as they were giving me, and – I just fell in love with the whole airport scene.
That's so cool. So, and obviously you just took off with flying. I imagine you kept doing that. And did you pursue aviation in college, or what was kind of the next steps for you?
A lot of people don't probably know this. I love running a business as much as I love flying a plane. To me, it's just as challenging. So I quickly started to sort of be my dad's right hand in a way. My mom ran the books, made sure there was enough money in the bank to make the payroll every week. My dad was out flying airplanes and giving check rides and all that. And then I became sort of the eyes and ears on the ground, even from a young age. So I started to, yes, learn to fly. I soloed at 16, got my private at 17 and all that. And then by the time I was 18 years old, I was going to college locally so I can continue to work at the school, and then became sort of the head of all the flight instructors. And for everybody that's a pilot today and is going through this amazing hiring boom that the airlines have been doing for the past few years, well, that happens every so often, and it happened in the 1980s. And I was the kid that was interviewing and hiring all these flight instructors who would then leave the airlines with like 800 hours total time, which is kind of what's happening today. It all comes around, and then it's a cycle. So I started to, yes, learn to fly, and then also learned how to run our business at the same time. And I think one of the things that I'm probably a little unique in is that after all these years, I still love to fly today as much as I did the first day that I did it. And because the aviation business, it's a hard way to make a living. Let's be honest, right? It's a pretty hard, and there's a lot of sort of crusty old guys and ladies out there and wives that are running these businesses for their whole lives. And they kind of get a little bit, they just get hardened to the whole thing, and they forget to see what the magic of flying is and all the great things. And I've been lucky that I've been able to keep that spirit within me. So when I get up in the morning and go to work, it's still just as magical for me as it is. And don't get me wrong, aviation is still a business for me, but it's my passion for it that makes me drive as hard today as I did even back
then. Yeah, it does. And that's one thing I always told like kids when I went to speak at high schools and things like that. It's like, you have to find some kind of passion in life to pursue. Otherwise it's just a job where you're just, I mean, you're literally just waking up to punch a clock and just get through the week so you can make it to the weekend. So is that why, I mean, is it the passion that drove you to be successful, to pursue, to work hard? Because your passion definitely shows in the flying that you do. And all our time together, mainly spent at air shows, like, you know, the Goulian name is iconic. And that is what you think of, at least what I think of when it comes to aerobatics and things like that, because of the amount of passion you brought to flying and bring. So,
yeah, I mean, well, I mean, it's nice of you to say that. I'll give you $20 when this is over. It's funny. I try to tell people, I never had a goal to be this or do that or whatever. However, I'm somebody that whatever I'm going to do, I'm going to do it absolutely as best as I can, right? So whether it's running our business or flying an airplane or flying an aerobatic airplane or playing golf or playing ice hockey, like, I don't want to be bad at anything. Right. So if I can't be trying to turn a work towards being a scratch golfer, I don't want to do it. I don't want to be a hacker. Like, same thing for flying and all of those things. I want to try to be the best that I can, but I'm not sure I set out like, oh, I want to win a national championship, or I want to make that much money in my business, or I want to do that. It's just one of those things. Like, I don't know what I would do in the morning if I didn't get up with a goal. So for me, it's all about a goal thing. I need to set something out there and go get it, right? With our new aviation business, I tell all the people, I'm like, our goal should be to be the best in the entire country and have everybody else look to us and say, that's how you should do it. Like, I don't want to be like everybody else. I want everybody else to try to be like us. And I think that kind of like that motivates everybody else when they come to work. They're like, this is a group of people. They want to rock it. And I think that also brings in really great people into your company. It's how you build something great. And so, you know, I'm not the best aerobatic pilot that's ever been. Maybe I'm one of the most passionate, I think. And I still love it. And I look at airshow flying and I just went out practicing today. In the middle of the coronavirus world, you look down at the world and you go, doesn't look like there's anything wrong with the world from 3,000 feet. And then, you know, when you look outside and you're like, I can't believe that this airplane is mine and I get to do this. Cause when I was a 15-year-old kid, it was really just a dream. And so I feel lucky that I'm able to continue to do what I'm doing today. Cause as you all know, you've been in the airshow business yourself. To be able to make it a vocation is a pretty difficult task. So I feel lucky that I've been able to do that.
Luck obviously is probably a small piece of it, but I think the biggest piece is that passion and really the hard work and that dedication that I think that you're kind of alluding to there is, I don't know. And that's what I wonder. Is it, you know, do you get lucky, land in the right spot, you find something you're passionate about, and then you have that drive to be a hard worker and wanting to be the best? Cause I know for me, it's always been like, I never want to be the person who lets the team down. I never want to be the weakest link. I always want to be the best. I always want to push further and go faster. So I don't know. I think that's a challenge for some people. And I don't know, do you have any advice for maybe how you find that blend or how you work to that?
Man, I think it's, I honestly think it's ingrained, right? I didn't know that. I had some coaches in high school and hockey that were pretty influential in the way that I looked at life and things. And I look at my dad and how he dug deep to try to make a living in what he did every day. And, you know, and I look at, when you talk about passion, I look at you right there. So there's a lot of F-16 pilots. There's been a bunch of Thunderbirds, but when you say to people that have been in the airshow business for the last 10 years, hey, do you know Rain? Everybody knows Rain, right? And the reason they do is because I think you brought a passion to the performance that a lot of other people didn't do. A lot of other people were awesome, but to me, the greatest aviators are able to show their passion and their love for what they do and their personality through a machine, right? And that's hard to do because you're a couple of thousand feet or a few thousand feet away from the audience. But if you can make a machine behave in such a way that, like, listen, you could put 1,000 gray F-16s on the ramp and you can have 1,000 different demo pilots. But as soon as you took off and you did the takeoff that you did, I'm like, oh, that's Rain. I get it, right? Like, I can see it. And you don't know that you have it, but you just have it. And I think it's the same with me. I want, if I'm in a purple extra or a yellow extra or a green extra, I want somebody to stand at Oshkosh and go, oh, that's Mikey G flying, because they can tell. And it's all of my life experience that's put into the flight controls of this airplane to make a statement in the sky, right? And I think that's the thing that we wanted, that people want to do, that they should try to make a statement in their life with whatever it is that they're doing. To be able to make a statement with what you are passionate about, it's a special gift that people are given. And I think not a lot of people really understand their passion in life and are given the opportunity that we have been given to be able to,
yeah,
to
absolutely. Do that. Now, do I have to give you $20 back? Yeah.
Yeah, you do.
No, I think.
Actually, 40 yeah. bucks, I think.
No, I mean, your words couldn't be truer. I think we're definitely both fortunate in the sense to be able to share our passion, be able to go out there and do our passion and share it with people and try to do the best of our ability. But, you know, it definitely, I would say, takes a lot of hard work and dedication. I know you would agree with that as well. Yeah, what, sure. So kind of along those lines, right? It's not necessarily an easy road. And particularly right now, as we're recording this, coronavirus is obviously rampant. And it is a big deal for everyone across the globe, but you're a business owner. So what are some of the challenges you're facing now with your business? How are you addressing those? How are you, you know, persevering and pushing through this?
Yeah, you know, it is definitely a scary time, right? As a small business owner, you think you do, but you never ever have the opportunity to build up a war chest of money like some of the larger corporations do. So you're always, you know, you're always looking at the bank and your bank balance, and you're always looking at the revenue that's going to come in, and you get some sleepless nights. It really is. And that saying is, if it was easy, everybody would do it. Well, right now is one of those times, right? And so it's a hit. And when I think about our air show business, especially, I have some sponsors that have paid me quite a bit of money for this year, and there's no air shows to fly. So the thing that you have to do is you have to sit down with your sponsors and say, okay, it wasn't our fault, but that doesn't matter. We didn't deliver the product to you that was expected. So we sit down with those people and say, listen, we're in this together, right? And so I realize this is hard for our sponsor, but it's also hard for us, but we will sort of work with them over a period of time to make sure that they're comfortable with that. So it won't be the next year that hurts. It's probably the next few years that will hurt. Because when I look at Wheeland Aerospace and these companies, they're like, hey, it's basically a loss that we will have to try to disperse over a few years worth of involvement. So it's a few years worth of lean times, and it is what it is. But again, I'm thankful just to be able to continue to do it for sure.
What do you think is going to happen with air shows this year? Do you think we're going to have anything?
Boy, I certainly hope so. My next air show on the books is late August in Maine.
And that show.
It's awesome, right? We're hopeful. I certainly hope so. I think if you think about air shows in general, they're outdoors. Can people socially distance at an air show like that? Yeah, if they want to, they can. I think they can. And the military has done an amazing job of really raising the spirits of all of the people of the country, and not only the country, but the first responders, especially all the people that have been working so hard during this time. So I think for once, air shows have been looked upon in a positive light. So I think when you talk about America, there's nothing greater than going to an air show and watching people do amazing things in magical machines like airplanes. So I'm hoping that a lot of people will see air shows for what it is. And it's an opportunity for people to go to a place as a family and be inspired. And there's not a lot of places in the country that you can say that about anymore, but air shows are one of them. And so I'm super hopeful that we'll be able to fly the last third of the season for sure.
Obviously, it's a crushing thing for the air show industry. All the other industries go along with it, but if we talk specifically about the air show industry, just shutting the doors completely and those ramifications, like you've already alluded to, I mean, there are second and third order effects that take years to recover if they're recoverable at all. Because a lot of the other performers going to air shows is their primary business. So there's no other business on the side. So when you shut their only revenue stream down, it's kind of scary to think who is going to come out of this if this goes on much longer. So,
yeah, that's right. I think when you look at what people don't realize is when you go to air shows, there's people that it is their sole source of income, and they're not making tons and tons of money by doing it. It's a passionate business. And, you know, some of the best are, you know, you think about Kyle Franklin, you think of Rob Holland, you think of Matt Youngkin, and all of these guys out there that are really, they're doing it because they love it. It's their full-time business. And so it's a tough spot for them to be in. And I hope the airshow industry actually supports them in a time of need, because they should.
With like Matt Jolly, Rick Peterson, Rob, you know, those guys getting together and actually doing this socially distant air show was pretty incredible. I think they raised like $25,000 for air show performers, which is pretty cool, because again, you know, my short time in the air show world, it definitely is a family, and coming together in hard times is what it's all about. So hopefully the doors open back up at some of these air shows here in the fall, and people can get out there and celebrate freedom and America and enjoy things as a family, and we can get the world turning again.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's amazing how fast we could turn it off.
If you'd asked me about 7 weeks ago, whenever this kind of kicked off, it was going to happen. I was actually in China when it all kind of started. It was really churning up. And they had, you know, they'd sealed everything off in China, and I was like, we'll never do this in America, you know, and then fast forward 3.5 weeks and we were shutting everything down. So hopefully it's gotten ahead of, you know, the virus and allowed everyone to adjust. And again, hopefully it'll fizzle out. I'm sure we'll have some more flare ups, but now we can manage it.
For sure.
Shifting gears just a little bit. You used to race airplanes on occasion too. Is that correct?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
I think you were involved in Red Bull Air Race. I have to look at my notes here. Yeah. So you did some Red.
Hey, you should have done your research.
I didn't know. I thought I had Rob Holland on for tonight. And
I see. Yeah. No, he just flies upside down. That's all.
All the time.
Oh, he plays a guitar pretty well.
Yeah. So I had a scramble here when I realized it wasn't Rob Holland on the line, but
And Rob lives in New Hampshire. Does the internet?
I don't think so. They're still out in the woods or whatever whatever it is. Yeah, I haven't heard from Rob. I don't know what he's doing these days.
You'll have to get a can and a string and maybe connect that to Georgia.
Neshua, is that how do you say it? I don't know. Yeah,
Neshua. Yeah, something like that.
It's hard for us Georgia boys to say that. How did you get involved in Red Bull racing?
So amazing enough. I did my first race. It was an exhibition in Reno, and Kirby Chambliss called me. And in 2004, and said, hey, this Red Bull Air Race thing is getting going. It's really cool. And they're looking for basically professional pilots from around the world that had been in world championships. So they had a bunch of name recognition, but also were comfortable low level. And they were sort of comfortable in their own skin because, let's face it, in the beginning, we were learning as we went, and it was pretty dangerous, right? And so they want – Peter Bessonnier was kind of the guy – if people don't know, Peter Bessonnier in the 70s, 80s, and 90s was, you know, one of the kings of the world of aerobatic flying. And Peter's an amazing guy. He's from Hungary, lives just outside of Budapest. And Peter was in charge of it, and he basically – he almost handpicked the people to be a part of the race. And I like to tell people in the beginning, they chose people that wanted to live more than they wanted to win, right? Because like that was kind of the idea. Like, hey, let's get this thing off the ground. Nobody be stupid. It's incredibly challenging flying. It's the hardest flying you'll ever do. It's the hardest flying I've ever done and maybe ever will do. But we needed to get from point A to point B, and they needed a bunch of people in the seat that were super trustworthy and responsible and professional, so that there were no accidents in the first bunch of years to get this thing going. And so it was really in that time by invitation only in 2004. So I did a flight, a race in 2004 in Reno. It was just an exhibition, which was really fun. And then in 2005, I didn't race. That was the first sort of real season. And then I went to the very last race of the season and just participated in the practice events. And then in the very late fall of 2005, believe it or not, we set up a Red Bull Air Race track behind Kirby Chambliss' house. Was like completely surreal. So here's a Red Bull Air Race track in Kirby's backyard, which if you don't know is, you know, in Arizona in the desert. And here's a full up group of pylons. And Goody Thomas, who's a competition pilot, and I were both invited to go. And we flew for 3 or 4 days. And at the end, I was chosen to join the Rebel Air Race starting in 2006. Sort of as they say, the rest is history from there. And I was with the series from 2006 all the way through its final year there in 2019.
That's wild. I had no idea. So was it a tryout at Kirby's place, more or less? They just invited a bunch of pilots and to see
it who- was. Yeah. It was a tryout. It was actually the Budapest track from 2005 that we flew in, and we practiced this thing. And you did this whole 3 or 4 days worth of flying, and the hardest part of the whole thing, and the funniest thing, but I think back now, my wife stood underneath the gate with a video camera, which back then was not an iPhone. Because the ending was, hey, Michael, you have to hit the pylon. Huh. And I was like, you want me to hit the pylon? Like, yeah, you have to hit it. Passing the course is hitting the gate. And I was like, oh, man. and people remember my cap 232. I was in my Castrol cap. And it took me 3 times to hit the pylon. Because rain, you know. Like, hey, go fly your airplane into that thing. I'm like, nope, what, are you thanks. Kidding me? No, thank you. And even today, like we did a demo at Sun and Fun a few years ago, and it was the same thing. It was we were doing a demo, and like the first day, Kirby hits a pylon. The second day, I hit a pylon, and it was my day to hit the pylon, and I couldn't hit the pylon. And Kirby's yelling at me on the airplane, on the radio, you jerk, blah, 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 I'll do it. And he just center punches it because Kirby has no brains anyway. So that's just the way it is, right? And so that was my intro to the Red Bull Air Race. Like, they're like, you have to pass the course by hitting one of these things. And it is the craziest. Now, I've hit hundreds of them over the course of my 10 years, right? I mean, I've hit so many pylons. I mean, I can't even, there's definitely can't even count, but I've never hit one on purpose.
Oh, I can't even, like, even though, you know, like, right. I mean, it's tearing away. It's filled with air. Like, it's going to do no damage. Still, like, I'm not going to go purposely run into something in my plane. Mm-mm. That's only inviting bad things to happen.
God. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Go jump off that bridge. Why? Yeah. Right. Yeah. Like, why would you do
no
that?
Thanks.
Yeah, yeah, the next guy
no thanks. It. No, thank you. I'll move on. Gosh. What made, I mean, I'm envisioning why that was such tough flying. You're used to flying down low. I've seen you fly. What was the hardest part of Red Bull flying? What made it so challenging?
You know, the funny thing is, the flying low had nothing to do with it, right? Like, it was just one of those, it's a given. You're like, you're comfortable down low. You don't even know it. And then we flew over the water so much that, like, I forgot that you get so comfortable. I forgot that we were over the water. It didn't dawn on me. All I could see is a track and these pylons out the windscreen, and that was it. You know, starting in about 2016, and we were behind this game for a while, but we caught up in the end of 2017, and then all of 2018 and 19, we were the team to beat almost all that time. Matt Hall, Martin Shanka, and myself, we were the three best teams at the end of 17, 18, and most of 19, and Yoshi Moroya as well, from Japan. The flying got so incredibly technical, it was insane, right? So we would, the head of aero and astrophysics at MIT was essentially our tactician, right? So we would get a track, and he would build the perfect racing line with 17 different wind conditions.
Jeez.
And so we would build the track on Google Earth, and then he would email me this big KML file, and I would learn every single track, all 17 of these wind conditions in a video over and over and over. And then I would go to my hangar, and I would set the track up on the floor of my hangar with Red Bull cans, funny enough.
Naturally.
And then I would draw arrows on the ground from like what the wind condition would be, what the gate angles were. And so I would just walk through the thing every day for 3 weeks prior to a race. And then I would understand the G levels and everything else that was involved to do this. So you would get to the racetrack and you are programmed to go. And then the first couple of days were learning. So the airplane would download 180 lines of data 5 times per second. So everything that you could ever think of, acceleration, deceleration, indicated airspeed, true airspeed, ground speed, G levels, height, altitude, bank angle, pitch, all this kind of yaw rate, all these things. And so when I would come back, they would take the data card out of the airplane, stick it in the computer. Pablo Branco would, who was basically the coach, and he would basically dissect all this and then take the data from the airplane and overlay it on the very complicated data that Steve Hall, our tactician from MIT, had created. And then we would look at that. Where was he pulling too hard? Where was it too soft? The angle was all of those things. However, that it's incredibly technical, and I'm just a dumb pilot, right? So we had a thing, Pablo and I, because he's an aerobatic pilot, we had a thing. I'm like, Pablo, I can only change 3 things at a time, right? So, and another thing was we also, as a team, Pablo and I both had a sports psychologist who would work with both of us independently. So, yep. So the sports psychologist knew how I worked. He knew how Pablo worked. And then he tried to talk to both of us independently so that we would both mesh up together. Right. And so we talked the same. And so Pablo would be like, hey, I need you to squeeze a little more around 6, or I need you to let off a little more into gate 7. Whereas the MIT guy would say, I need you to be 1.5 degrees more around. Like, that doesn't work. Like, yeah. Hey, Jack, I'm an athlete. I'm not a
computer. I'm not an engineer, bro.
I'm not an engineer. That's the way this was. So, and that was the magic. And the hard part about the Red Bull Air Race is that on any given weekend, three people would be close to perfect. And it was so hard to be like in any sporting event, whether it's golf or tennis or whatever it is, there's always one person that's just a little bit better on everybody than everybody else. They're I hate to use this term, but they're in the zone that day, right? And so the whole thing was trying to get in the zone where it all became easy, because the people you were flying against were so good that it had to be perfect. It had to be like 99.9% perfect. And that was the hardest part about it, was that you couldn't make a mistake.
Yeah.
And when I say mistake, I mean like you pulled, you know, 11G instead of 11.5G around that court, like 0.5Gs. Like, what does that mean? But that's the difference between winning or losing.
Knowing that level of detail is really impressive, and definitely, you know, clarifies the answer of like why it's not just flying low to the ground, why it's so challenging just to go out there, because it is such a precise sport.
Yeah. And the thing that that doesn't come across on TV and didn't come is that it was essentially a psychological battle, because everybody knew what you had to do. Right. So let's talk about the rules. So in 2018, the rule was the G limit was 10, right? But you could go up to 12 for 0.5 seconds. So you were given this baby window. And the reason that was given was in the day I was in the meeting, we were like, hey, the G limit's 10. And then they said, yeah, but what if it's really bumpy? You're like, okay, we'll let you have a spike to 12, but only for half a second. Well, that was meant to be a bump for the G meter to go up and over. However, we started to use that to our advantage. So, of course, right? So what we did is when you go through a gate, our goal was to pull to 11.9 for 0.45 seconds and let off to 9.9, which reset the clock, by the way, and then back to 11.9. And then by that time, the airplane was going through vertical, and it was going to basically get around the corner and dissipate the G before it over-G'd. And so, but now when this is one of the things that Pablo would look at is the rate of acceleration. And when I was doing, when I was in the groove at my best, flying without just on instinct, my pitch rate was like 80 something degrees per second. So if you think about, right, like it'll go from zero to 11.9 G's in less than a second through vertical and then off the stick and back. So it was completely instinct. And the needle moves so fast, like you could never ever look at the needle, because it was pegged before you could do it. And so the person that would win was the person that's like, I have no fear. I'm going to go to that gate. I'm going to go to 11.9 and off to 9.9 and back to 11.9 and hold it all in 1.2 or 3 seconds. And like, that was honestly the difference between winning or losing. And when I was not in the groove, I wouldn't win. Like, and that like, it honestly almost all came down to that, is how in the zone were you? How did you do? Like, you have to care only so much. And that's the thing, is like, and there you go, I can fly as great as I can without any reservation for any failure and win, or I can do 95% of it and come in fifth. And you're like, huh? Because the consequences of going over G is like you're a 10th.
Yeah.
Right. So it was an interesting psychological thing, and it was a very delicate balance for me all the time. Like I would I went to a race, and before I got on the airliner, Emily Mankins, my team coordinator, took my telephone, my computer, she took my iPad, and I was completely isolated for like 11 days. So I would go from the airport to my hotel. I had a book. I would read a book. I would go to sleep. I would get back up. I was disconnected from everything. I had a phone. I had a race phone, which had basically my team's phone numbers and my wife, and that's
that, it. That's probably why you're one of the okayest pilots I know.
Okay. I'm okay. My daughter thinks I'm
He's okay at best. No, I mean, it's that level of detail, that amount of, you know, dedication to it that separates first place from second place and first place from 10th place. And not everyone has that. I mean, the margins there are so small. Like it is phenomenal to me and really impressive.
Yeah. And it's funny when the race stopped, cause I was done with traveling, like you doing all the traveling that you do now, you know, it gets tiring, right? You're like, oh my God. And I would sit in a hotel in Abu Dhabi and be like, remember how tired you are. Remember this when you get home. Remember this when they want you to do it next year. Like you can barely raise your arms off the bed. You're so tired with jet lag. But now I sit back and I'm like, man, I miss the nerves of race day, right? I miss the nerves of being dry in my mouth for like 10 hours, knowing that like today is the day I've got a race. It's funny.
Here's a simple question I probably should know, but like, the logistics of it, getting the plane there. And then what are you doing like with your body as far as like adjusting your body clock, getting on that? I know you probably have a certain, you know, 5 or 6 days probably to warm up to it, I would imagine. But how's that process? That's not a small muscle movement to move a whole team in a plane.
No, it was. So every race we went, there were two 747s, usually. I can't remember the name. Atlas Cargo would move the stuff usually. If not, then it was Emirates. And with the nose-loaded airplanes, the 777 or the 747, and they would move the whole circus from one country to the next. So our team would, like, we would, let's say we finished a race, and, I mean, the engine is still bubbling hot, and Warren, my technician, he's taking the airplane apart. They're like, out. Wow. And they had no wasted movement by 9:30, 10 o'clock on Sunday night. The airplane was basically apart. And then by about 10 o'clock the next morning, they put it into a box. So the wing went into a thing that looks like a huge guitar case. Same thing for the tail. And then you shrink wrap the airplane and then strap it down to the floor of this of what they, we call a cookie sheet. You might know that in FedEx language. So it became the cookie sheet. And then they would take that and load them into the 747 and off they go. And then we'd come somewhere, you know, 4,000 miles away from where the last race was. And there's my airplane, just like we left it, sitting in the same hangar, ready to be reassembled. It was magic.
Yeah, that's that is no small feat. Like that's
no.
What, yeah, I mean, any insight that you could share for why it all ended, or was it just cost prohibitive, or like what do you think?
You know, I think that the model was a little bit broken. I think they wanted to sort of, basically, if you look at the Rebel Air Race, it was very much modeled after Formula One. So the way our timing and scoring sheets were, and the way the whole thing went, and the weekend's progression, and the terminology in the race, it was very much Formula One. And I think the thing is, Formula One has a 100-year head start, right? Yeah. And so it grew organically. And so the way the air race worked is they looked to the cities to pay a host city fee, as opposed to fans and beverage and food sales and sponsorship and things like that. So I think in an economy of today, to ask a city to pay multi-millions of dollars to host an event it's a pretty difficult ask. It's even difficult for Formula One to do today.
Yeah.
Right. If you look on the Formula One schedule, races are coming and going, and it's some of these emerging countries, Azerbaijan and places like that, that are actually hosting the races because they want it for tourism. Yet Red Bull wanted to go to establish, they wanted to go to mainland Europe. They wanted to go to the United States. They wanted to go to Australia, places like that, which already were established and didn't need that. So I think the racing is the most purest form of aviation that you can find. I hope it comes back. There are some groups that are trying to put it back, but it is no small task, right? Yeah. It's 200 people traveling around the globe. It's a big deal. And, you know, all I can say to Red Bull is thank you. Cause it was, they literally showed me the world. They gave me some of the best memories that I'll ever get from flying and the places that I flew and what we did. And the way that they treated us was amazing. So all I can do is hope that it continues, whether I continue with it as a pilot or as a coach or as a team owner, I don't really know. But I still have my race plane. It's actually being assembled in Florida, and it's going to come up to Pablo's going to keep it in his hangar in New York, and he's just going to keep it exercised. And so we'll see what happens in the future.
Well, I hope it comes back. I mean, it's such an incredible sport that I enjoyed watching. I know so many people other, you know, really enjoyed it. So
hope, yeah, it was fun.
Hopefully it'll happen. What was the pinnacle of your time during Red Bull?
For me, I think winning in Indianapolis was, it was unexpected for me. It was a hard week. We had a bunch of challenges prior to the race week starting. And you know, we were at that point, we were underdogs for the world championship. We were third, and a bunch of things had to happen. Basically, I had to crush Matt Hall and Martin Zonka to get back into the world championship picture anyway. And we did that. Like, those guys had bad races. I went on to just, again, get in the groove. It was one of those things. It was just a magical day. And I've watched Indianapolis and Formula One since I was a kid. It just captivated me. And I love history of the military and sports and golf and Formula One and even aerobatic flying. And so Pablo always laughs at me because he's like, "You were crying." And I'm like, yeah. There's this picture of me crying like a baby. Thanks, Red Bull, they had a camera in my face, because I was like, man, because my dad died 20 years ago. And, you know, he didn't know that any of this was going to happen, but he, you know, he saw me win the Nationals, which was a very cool thing. But I sat there and I'm like, man, as an American, I just won an iconic race at America's most iconic racetrack.
Yeah.
It was an overwhelming thing. And so it's one of those things that nobody can ever take away from you. And so I think when I look back at Red Bull, that was a pretty magical day.
That's so cool. It lends well into, I mean, probably the best day of your life was May 25th, plus or minus 2019. Yeah,
couple days. What did I do that day? I don't remember. Yeah,
I can't remember. Were you flying on the backseat of an 810 or?
No, yeah, it was something. It was kind of pointy. There was this funny looking guy flying it. I don't remember his name. John something. Yeah,
something
or other.
Has been. He's gone.
Yeah, call sign Rain. Yeah. I think he flies big airliners today or something like that. Yeah,
just not the same. No, like the really cool. I mean, for me, it was awesome going to Indy for the Indy 500 a few months later, and then linking up with you and be able to fly with you in the backseat of the F-16. Was that your first time in the backseat, or did you?
As an honorary Blue Angel, what I'm about to say might get my honorary status revoked. But I've had the honor of flying with the Blues, but flying in an F-16 with you doing BFM was an absolute, like, it was the greatest thing that has ever happened to me. It was like people don't realize, they're like, how was your F-16 ride? Like, it was crazy. People are like, well, what was it like? I said, well, it felt like I was in a washing machine for like 20 minutes. And it was awesome. It was sick.
Well, you know, like I had a blast because I mean, it's so much fun, I think, to share aviation and share like your plane with another aviator who gets it. And so not that I've had people in the backseat who didn't get it, but it was really cool to have someone who definitely did get it. And as we went out there, we, you know, put the F-16 through its paces and then coming back and letting you fly it, you know, fly it around. Because the side stick's a little bit different, right?
Yeah. I fly it around. Not very well, I might add. But please don't ever show that picture of me trying to do a 4-point roll in your jet, by the way.
Have the video. It could be a good primer for this this podcast, or maybe afterwards.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot. Was that a 4-point roll or an 8-point roll? I can't really remember or tell because it was kind of blended.
I mean, to your credit, I'll give you, it did have a centerline tank on it, which did make it a little more sluggish.
Yeah, that was what's wrong with it. I knew there was a problem with the plane. Yeah.
I mean,
all the other F-16s I flew, they were way better than the one that we were in.
I mean, I never had a problem with that, but I get it. It was like the first time you did that. So yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, but I was helping you on the one that you were doing.
It was a lot of coaching from the back seat. I really do appreciate that.
No, it was, it was the amount of thrust on takeoff was just, it's indescribable, right? It's so fun. And I'm a single seat, single engine guy, and the F-16, it just, like, I don't know, it almost seems like they started with the pilot and they built the airplane around it, right? It's still today an airplane that looks futuristic to me. Now it's what, 30 years old, right?
Yeah, it's crazy. They just keep making them and they're gonna keep improving it, which is awesome. But it kind of ties too, right, to the extra, all of that, like being single seat. I mean, I know they're two seat variants and things like that, but when you go out to an air show, as you're flying Red Bull, I mean, it's just you and the machine strapped in there. I don't think the F-16 could do 90 degrees per second in the vertical.
It's going a little too fast.
Yeah. You would just be crushing people at BFM if you were able to.
Oh my God. Could you imagine?
Just turn and point and shoot wherever you want. Kind of like a Hornet, but, that was a really cool. And for me, I mean, that was pretty much it. I think, I flew the F-16 the next day and the Indy 500, and I did one more F-16 flight back at Shaw, like a demo farewell. So
that's it, really.
Yeah. So it was really cool to kind of be able to round that out.
Okay.
Yeah. Share it with, again, one of the OKS pilots I know.
it was a magical day, and we got so many amazing pictures. That's really, and oh, by the way, my screenshot, as I'm looking at it on our computer right now, is me sitting in the back of the airplane with you.
That's
it's funny. And as you know, Brian Bishop, who was the commander of the Thunderbirds and a 2-star in the Air Force, works with me. And so we're always in the same office, and clearly he's an F-16 son. And every time he walks in the office, I'm like, Brian, did I tell you that I flew an F-16? He's like, no. I never heard that. I'm like, yeah, I flew an F-16. That's a picture of. He's like, no, really, is it? I'm like, yeah, that's me in there. He's like, I would never know.
I had a screenshot. Yeah, I edited that and screenshot it. It was awesome. No, I, Mike, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat here tonight. Before we part ways, is there anything you'd like to say to the listeners? Advice, tips, tricks for life, or whatever it might be. It could be short term, could be long term. You're wise beyond your years. Listen.
I am not wise beyond my ears. I don't know if you, I'm not sure I have anything of wisdom to say, but other than like the people that are clearly listening to this podcast, know you, probably know me as, passionate people that really have enjoyed doing something that we love so much. And for those people to go out there, and if they're contemplating what's my next step in life, as you said earlier, just go do it. Just go take it and never look back.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a perfect way to end this. Just again, sage advice from Michael Goulian.
Love you, brother.
Yeah, thanks for joining here. I really do appreciate you taking the time. This has been awesome catching up. and just chatting and getting a little bit of your story out there, because I know people are really going to enjoy it. And just all the stuff you have accomplished and all the things you keep doing in life, it's an inspiration. And I'm very fortunate to call you a friend and be able to spend time with you and pick your brain from time to time.
You as well, brother. Thank you for having me on here.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for listening to today's podcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks. But until next time, don't bring it weak.